Hey everyone, welcome to the Working Triathlete Podcast. I'm here with Conrad, and we have a special guest today, Zach Kramer, who is the Director of Sports Performance at PM Medical. He is also a coach with strength and conditioning, but also is a breath coach, which we'll talk a little bit more about. But his background, you know, started with his interest in strength and conditioning during his college football career. And, you know, first experienced the benefits of functional breathing on his own for his physical and mental well-being. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that today and some studies that, you know, he's worked with different athletes from MMA fighters, golfers, swimmers, weightlifters. And, you know, we're a triathlon podcast and he's worked with one of my own athletes as well. And we'll talk about her experience and improvements with breathing as it pertains to Zach, you know, coaching her on best practices and things like that. So Zach, welcome to the podcast and, you know, go ahead and share a little bit more about yourself.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. I think you covered most of the bases there. Yeah. I was always really into strength and conditioning. And then I kind of just, one day started trying out some breathing stuff and fell down the whole rabbit hole of breathing and haven't looked back and just brought that really into the main focus of my coaching.
Yeah. And it seems like this concept of breathing and it seems like it's being studied more or certainly talked about more because the positive impacts are tremendous, I guess, on both performance and well-being. And certainly in this podcast, obviously endurance athletes are listening to it, but can you talk a little bit about the positive impacts that you've observed working with athletes on the endurance training side?
Yeah, from the endurance side, and really what's nice about the endurance side is that's been kind of studied the most with a lot of these things. So strength athletes, there's a lot more anecdotal kind of evidence, but for whatever reason, the endurance side has really gotten some studies done on various types of breathing exercises and the impact there. So what I'll start maybe with before I jump into this kind of more the feeling that some of my athletes get, I guess I'll talk more about how I measure kind of some of those things. Like when I work with an athlete one-on-one, and the two biggest things I'm measuring when I work with an athlete are, and we can go deep down into what these things are, I guess, as we go, but I look at their carbon dioxide tolerance. So I'll measure their tolerance to carbon dioxide, and that gives us a base measure at the beginning. And then we measure that throughout. And then I'd look at just physically watching them, how they breathe. So their breathing mechanics, whether they're breathing low and slow, they're able to use their diaphragm versus being like a chest shoulder breather. And we'll see how we track that throughout, like continue to come back and evaluate that. And then just their overall strength of their inhale and exhale.
So I want to jump back real quick to the carbon dioxide tolerance. So how do you measure that and what exactly does that mean?
Right. So there's a few different ways you can measure it. Different programs out there, like different certifications and schools of thought have different tests. The one I like the most is just what I call the walking carbon dioxide test, make it as easy as possible. Basically, all you're going to do is you take a normal inhale, normal exhale, hold your breath after that exhale, and you walk as far as possible. You count your steps and you just go for broke. And so once you have to breathe, you stop, you count your steps, and that's your score. So it's pretty, you know, it's not the most scientific test in the world, but it works and it's repeatable for each athlete. So the biggest thing is obviously testing against yourself in that. And I mean, it's pretty amazing. Even whether they're endurance athletes or general population, most people get, I'd say, low 20s the first time they do it. And usually general population, people I work with, they're just not even athletes. I'm trying to get them to 60. Wow. Athletes, I'm trying to be at 80 to 100 plus.
Okay.
And you can definitely improve that, but yeah, it's pretty staggering how much we're all pretty intolerant to carbon dioxide, even if you're an endurance athlete.
So one more question about this. Do you notice, is there certain sport types that have a higher tolerance that you work with? Like I'm thinking about swimming, for example, where you are forced to hold your breath. Do you notice like if there's certain sports where, or athletes that have a different tolerance level right off the gate?
Honestly, not really. It's kind of surprising. I've worked with a few swimmers and some swimmers over here at the University of Tennessee, and they're still pretty low. Maybe some of them, the only difference is that some swimmers are have been exposed to this before. So maybe they've dabbled in some breath holds now and then, and that will make a difference. So maybe they hit 40 or 50 their first try. But I've still had good swimmers in their 20s to 30s. Now, the other thing with athletes like that is they're committed to it because it's so relevant to swimming. And, you know, I've had swimmers there go from 30 to 100 pretty quickly.
That's interesting.
I'd say maybe the other piece, you know, kind of got my mind running now, thinking about who normally scores well right off the bat. That's kind of a fun thing to think about. I'd say also people who are just more relaxed throughout the day. Like you can, when you first meet an athlete, you can tell kind of just they're coming into a new city. I'm sure y'all see this too, right? Like somebody who you first like meet and onboard, you can get a kind of a gist of the type of person they are, of how they come into a new environment where they're going to commit to something new. And you can see if they're tense or not. If they're pretty relaxed, they'll do pretty well. But the more tense they are, man, they'll hit that wall quick and eyes will be watering and they're not sure what's going on.
Wow, that's an interesting fact there, and I guess it does make sense. Now, I remember swimming and the coach on deck always saying, you know, relax, you got to relax, and in swimming especially, you know, flexibility and kind of going with the flow is important, and I think that type of efficiency is important and essential even in well, swimming certainly, but also, you know, running and cycling. I know that the head coach of the NAU cross country team, Northern Arizona cross country team, which they've won a bunch of national champions, he basically screams at his runners to go to sleep for the first couple of miles. So they go out and they're like, all right, go to sleep, and then, you know, start working in the last couple of miles, because relaxed muscle is an efficient one, and you're not, you know, burning up oxygen and things like that. So that's pretty that's a cool fact.
Yeah, not to take us in a totally different direction, but something I've been personally really enjoying lately is I've been doing this breath routine that comes from the freediving community called breath tables. Have you all ever heard of breath tables?
No, I haven't heard of breath.
No. No, it's essentially just a tool that freedivers will use to really, I mean, the whole goal, right, is just make it get a bigger breath hold. And so they'll essentially, there's two different kinds, but essentially you have either you hold your breath for the same amount of time every round and then the rest between goes down, or the rest stays the same and the breath hold goes up. So pretty straightforward. But what's interesting about that is I've been doing those recently and they're super long breath holds, and you realize doing those how much you have to relax, because it's even if your brain starts to go on a tangent, like even just thinking, you can tell makes it harder. So it's funny how you mentioned relaxing like that, just made me think of that. I mean, you have it forces you to be relaxed as possible, because even thinking uses up energy.
And you know, I think of swimming and especially open water swimming, and that is certainly the biggest hurdle that triathletes face, many new triathletes face. You know, it's scary, you can't really see, oftentimes it's cold, so the propensity is to kind of hold on to your breath. And you know, I certainly think that triathletes, especially in swimmers, open water swimmers, benefit from thinking about this, and would benefit from breath training. Just because it's something that they can control and it has a direct impact on their ability to relax and deal with stress.
You asked about kind of what my athletes see as a result of working with me earlier on, and honestly, one of the things that's not really measurable, right? But one of the things I do here is just the breath awareness. Just focusing on this and just having the breath awareness makes them more efficient, whatever they're doing, whether they're swimming or they're biking or whatever it is. Just the awareness of like, oh, I can control my breathing, I can sink into my breathing. And if I focus on it, then I have control over it, versus like you said, like jumping into the water and all of a sudden you've held your breath for longer than you meant to and things happen. Versus once you become aware of it, it's not that you're constantly thinking of it, but if something is off, you feel it, right? And you can react and catch it and fix it.
And you mentioned CO2 tolerance earlier and how that's a big thing to track. And I think that panicky feeling when you're swimming is probably a direct result of that CO2 building up, and certainly that that panic that many athletes experience is that, and that happens if, you know, one is not breathing well, but also if they miss a breath, kind of, or they're getting hit over the head. It's a washing machine at the beginning of certain water swims. So that's, you know, right there is a direct reason to sort of think about CO2 tolerance.
There's a huge correlation between, just for the average person, that's a huge correlation between your tolerance to carbon dioxide and your stress levels. I mean, if you're not tolerant to carbon dioxide and you're just even just sitting doing emails and you feel that CO2 build up, you're going to feel more stressed. So absolutely. Like if you can become more tolerant then to that first part of the swim, you'll be just generally more relaxed, even in a chaotic situation.
And then one thing that might be worth talking about is how swimmers actually should breathe. I know there's some athletes, they like to just kind of hold on to their breath until the last second before they turn their head. And then it's a forceful exhale, and they turn and they get a gulp and they go back down. Others, you know, the constant exhale, good. But I mean, how do you think swimmers should think about that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So I haven't, there's ways I think about it from the breathing perspective, but I know it's also kind of a, I don't know, maybe not personal, but like, I'm sure there's so many ideas out there already, because so much of the breath in swimming is tied to technique and form. So when I, you know, I talk to people, I'll talk to coaches and I'll hear how they tell their athletes to breathe because of how they're coaching the stroke. So I've always kind of like left that up to the coach a little bit more, because I want to throw off how they're being taught with their stroke. Does that make sense? Like from a swimming technique side?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but from just the breath side of things, I mean, I can totally see, you know, if you can be more relaxed and do that slower exhale throughout, you're going to be more relaxed. You're going to have more control over it. But towards the end of a swim, I could totally see needing to drive. So when you're right, when we exhale, we're getting the CO2 out. And at some point you're going to probably shift into like an exertion gear where you need to be pumping out that CO2. Now, maybe at the beginning of your entire triathlon, you don't want to burn it all out on the swim, right? So you're hopefully, I'd imagine, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but hopefully you're not just at a dead sprint at the end of the swim, I would imagine, where you're needing to breathe like that. But if you were, then yes, I could see that powerful exhale coming into play.
Yeah, I know the swim is interesting too, because obviously the more air you have in your lungs, the more buoyant you are.
Right.
And so it affects body position too. So you mentioned like breathing out slowly, you're going to maintain that body position a little bit more as well.
Then also working, you know, triathlons is pretty much one stroke being done, but working with other swimmers, how you breathe is so dependent on whatever stroke you're competing in. And that makes a big difference, you know, breaststroke versus freestyle versus backstroke. It's all going to be dependent on, and so much of that also has to do with just your body position. So people are taking inhales in various positions with their torso, and that all has an impact on how your diaphragm is working. And
And so, but when we think about, I guess, the structure of the breath and the different positions you're talking about, the so there's this concept of diaphragmatic breathing or belly breathing, and it might be worth kind of touching on that, or at least, you know, what does a good breath look like?
Yeah. Maybe I'll even just, we'll go super fifth, sixth grade biology and just talk about what the diaphragm is for a second, and then go into kind of how it's supposed to look. Probably the biggest misconception out there is that your lungs kind of bring in the air and then expel it. But really your lungs are just empty sacs or balloons, and they don't do anything to get the air in and out. Your diaphragm is the muscle whose primary responsibility is to get air into your lungs. And so your diaphragm is kind of like this parachute shape, kind of like this, and then it sits right below your lungs. So it kind of separates your lungs and your heart from all of your guts, essentially. And it's a muscle that wraps, so it's connected to your ribs all the way around into your spine in the back. And just like any of the other muscle, it contracts and relaxes. And except for when it contracts, it pulls down And as it pulls down, it creates this, like if you think of a syringe, right? When you pull the plunger down on a syringe, air is pulled into the top. And that's the same thing that happens. So as the diaphragm contracts and draws down, air is pulled into the lungs. And as the diaphragm relaxes and goes back up, air comes back out. So when you see somebody breathing properly, ideally that diaphragm is pulling down, the diaphragm is relaxing, going back up, and we're doing a good job using the muscle we're supposed to use to breathe. But when we see dysfunctional breathing, like you brought up studies earlier, there was a study that they did where it showed competitive athletes that 90% of competitive athletes had dysfunctional breathing patterns. So it's not an athletic general pop type thing. Almost all of us from we've all heard the same story, right? Of eating the wrong foods, sitting so much as we grow up, all these things lead us to kind of breathe incorrectly. And we end up using our shoulders. Maybe you've seen people breathe using their shoulders or their chest. And essentially, what they're doing is using their shoulders and their chest to open up that cavity. And that pulls the air into the lungs because their diaphragm's essentially turned off. They just haven't used it in so long. They've been sitting in a weird position that made it hard to use the diaphragm. So that's one of the first things I look at is I just start with athletes flat on their back. I tell them to breathe as normally as possible without thinking about it too much, which is obviously hard to do when they're in there for a breathing evaluation. But and just kind of seeing, where they're breathing, how well do they do it naturally. And then I'll kind of take them through kind of some further challenges to make that harder and see if they can continue to breathe low into their belly.
That's this is interesting because it's almost like the reverse of how many people would expect breathing to go. So it's like the diaphragm kind of contracts and that allows the air in the lungs to go in, the lungs expand. And
Right.
so I guess this is important because really breathing with the diaphragm rather than the the chest muscles that and other leveraging the other muscles that you're kind of talking about is important because I guess it allows air to get in. And, I also wonder about kind of the metabolic cost. I mean,
Yes.
you're engaging any muscle requires energy. And if we want to preserve energy, then especially over a long course triathlon, then you want to be as efficient as possible. So it seems like a 1-2 punch, the benefits of breathing through the diaphragm.
Absolutely. I'll take that a step further. So my are either of y'all married?
We both
Yes.
are, yeah.
Okay. So I'm sure when you learn something new and you want to pass on information, maybe this isn't the same for you, but it's the same it is for me. Usually your spouse might be the last one to really listen to you. They'll listen to other sources or they'll kind of ignore you, right? And
Sounds
that's
about
why,
right.
so yeah. So my wife ran cross country and she didn't really start buying into a lot of the breathing stuff as I did early on. But then the one thing all of a sudden was this light bulb. So she ran cross country and she said this made all of a sudden this made total sense to her and was had a big impact was like you're talking about the energy cost with the diaphragm. And when what I was talking about that gave her the light bulb moment is this thing called blood stealing. And essentially what that means is your diaphragm will steal blood from your appendages. So your body, your brain especially, right, is just concerned with keeping you alive. And so it's really, really in tune with your diaphragm because it knows if your diaphragm shuts off, it's all going to get shut off. If you stop breathing, the game is over, right? So it really wants to make sure you keep breathing well and efficiently. And if your diaphragm gets tired, it wants to make sure it keeps getting enough oxygen. So what it does is it actually redirects oxygen-rich blood that'd be going to your legs or your arms to your diaphragm if it gets tired. So if you think about that from a performance side of things, even if you train your legs, your arms, you have all this muscular endurance, if you don't train your diaphragm, your legs and arms still might get tired just because they're no longer getting the oxygen-rich blood they need as it's diverted to your diaphragm. So that becomes a big piece of why we actually train the respiratory muscles to make sure they're efficient as well and they're not stealing blood from your legs and arms.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, efficiency across the board is important, and that's why even on easy runs, it is worthwhile thinking about, well, technique in general, but this gives you something else to focus on when you're running or even anything on the bike, swimming, you should also diaphragmatic breathe. So this is a good thing for athletes to think about, because it goes back to that concept is, and you have to train like you're going to race. So you can't all of a sudden just rely on your diaphragm when you're racing if you're not training it in training.
Yeah, absolutely. And with triathletes, one thing I think about as well is essentially the cycling piece of it, because it's this odd position that you have to be in. And so when you're hunched over, right, you're in this weird position that makes it hard to diaphragmatically breathe. So you mentioned, like, you've got to practice these things as well. You can't just all of a sudden hope to breathe right during competition. So we'll take athletes through, like we'll put them in a child's pose type position or get them really hunched over and force them to breathe, because like I mentioned earlier, diaphragm wraps around the back. It's almost easy to breathe into your belly, but it's kind of hard to breathe using your diaphragm through the back. And so I'll take cyclists through drills where, you know, we've talked about, I think before we hopped on, we talked about the breather fit. And so this just essentially adds resistance to your inhale and your exhale. So it can train the endurance side of things, but it can also train the strength of your diaphragm. So I'll take them in this kind of hunched over position, give them something like this, give them the breather fit to resist their breathing. And then they have to find ways they can breathe in that hunched over position efficiently. And that then translates to when they're on the bike.
Yeah, that's interesting. And as a nod to this concept of being able to breathe when you're cycling, we've definitely seen, I think over the last few years, a trend or a shift in bike fitting to be a little bit less aggressive. We're trying to open up that hip angle a little bit more. You want that 45 degrees or more. And, you know, we're finding that you can do that. And if you modify other things on the bike, there's no aerodynamic penalty, but athletes can actually breathe better.
Yeah, I didn't know that was going on, but that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And athletes are riding faster than ever because they're putting out more power than ever. And I think part of that is everybody can breathe a little bit better, but still certainly it's more difficult to breathe in aero than on a road bike when you're sitting straight up. But yeah, that's interesting stuff. And so I guess that going back to this concept of the strength of breathing muscles, I mean, to what extent is it useful in your opinion for, say, advanced endurance athletes? Like who would benefit most from using the device you're talking about? Advanced athlete, et cetera.
Honestly, I would say anybody where it's untrained. So, I mean, especially, and I think this is most relative probably to those elite athletes, because if you're now an elite athlete, you've trained, you know, like the difference in a certain program is going to give you a super small margin of increase at that point. Like when you're already close to your peak and everything, you're just fighting for seconds and inches, right, at that point. So if there's something that you haven't trained before, then anything you can improve there is going to be kind of exponential compared to things you've already trained almost to your limit. So I would completely say, or totally say, if you're, you know, this elite athlete, adding in respiratory muscular training and then adding in some maybe CO2 tolerance work, like kind of like breath hold type work on top of that, are going to be two factors that are going to really improve your results.
So this could be a good segue to talk a little bit about Katie, you know, one of my athletes, and just the work you've done with her. But do you want to go a little bit more in depth with, you know, what issues she was having and how you approach that, and then the results after?
Yeah. So with her, one of the biggest things was, you know, she was already a great athlete. And what's surprising about Katie is she was doing tremendously well already, but she was still having some wheezing during some of her races. And you know, there are some other things we found out later going on, but a lot of it sounded similar to sports-induced asthma. And so there's this aspect of that, but then also some aspects of the muscles in her throat being real tight. So it's just interesting that, you know, we've talked about the triathlete's pain threshold is unbelievable. So be able to push through all that stuff and still be getting the results she was doing was pretty crazy. But then there's this 1%, you know, little piece here where she could fix that. It's going to change a lot down the line. And the other thing too, I think, is just a confidence thing. I mean, if you're going into a race and you're concerned, is this going to start happening to me? There's always this little bit of a bug in the back of your head of wondering if it's going to happen or not. So anything to kind of make you more confident going into a race and then also take care of some of these issues is, and that's where we kind of began. So we began looking at her CO2 tolerance. We began looking at her breathing mechanics. And one of the things we started doing right away was just helping her to breathe more relaxed. Mm-hmm. So increasing the CO2 tolerance is one thing, but really where we began with her was thinking about how we breathe throughout the day, because she was a little bit more in the chest, a little bit more in the shoulders. Mm-hmm. And so just essentially me bugging her throughout the day of, okay, remember throughout the day, like set alarms on your phone or whatever. And every couple hours, just check yourself, like super easy, hand on chest, hand on belly. Where am I breathing right now? I'm walking around during work, or I'm sitting at work, or I'm maybe she was running, but just hand on chest, hand on belly, check in real quick a couple times throughout the day. And just, you know, it's like anything else. If you do something right throughout the day, it makes it easier when you're competing.
Mm-hmm.
Versus, you know, trying to all of a sudden do something really poorly throughout the day and then like turn it on all of a sudden when you start training. So yeah, it was more of a habit thing for her at first, getting those breathing mechanics correct. And then after we built that in, we began adding the breather fit, the respiratory muscular training. So that just, it's like adding weights for your respiratory muscles. So it just makes it, gives you resistance to inhale, resistance to exhale. And that helped her to essentially, what it does, if you're constricting your throat, like if we're breathing in and out using our face and our throat muscles, they're going to be a lot more tense. But if we can redirect that into our belly so that we're actually using the muscles we're supposed to, then your shoulders, neck, face relax a little bit more. And throughout that process, it's just helped her have less of those episodes where she's wheezing during races and is just more confident going into them.
Yeah. It's kind of like the same thing Conrad alluded to with the swim. If you go in and you're tense in the water, you know, her experience, you know, she probably started wheezing and got a little bit more tense and then just snowballed from there.
Right. Yep. And I think the ability for her, I know like things she's mentioned is just that awareness. Again, we talked about earlier, knowing how she can pull it back down if she needs to and control it a little bit versus it, like you mentioned, like it kind of snowballing and getting out mm-hmm. of control.
Yeah, I mean, races can be a chaotic event, but I think that it could be interesting analyzing the breath and exactly what's happening physiologically if we can.
Yeah.
When we think about inhaling and exhaling, and specifically the impact on each of those as it relates to calming you down, when we think about what should an athlete focus on, say if they want to relax, that extended exhale or what do you think there?
Yeah. I mean, there's like so many protocols and tips out there and numbers and seconds of all these things, but the easiest thing to just kind of wrap your mind around it, so you know where to start, is to go back to what the diaphragm is doing when we breathe. Like we mentioned earlier, when you breathe in, the diaphragm is contracting. Right. So it's pulling down and it's flexing essentially. So if you think about doing a bicep curl, right, as you pull up, your bicep is flexing and it's real tense at the top. Well, that's what your diaphragm is doing when you inhale. When you exhale, your diaphragm is relaxing and going up and kind of chilling out. So that's how we can think about what we want to focus on. If we need to relax, we're going to focus on that exhale. So if you inhale and hold your breath, you can feel how tense your whole body gets. And unfortunately, when you think about people who hold their breath throughout the day or even during exercise, most of the time it's on that inhale. And that's when we get that real tense sensation. And the exhale is the much more relaxing part of it. And you can actually see, I think you mentioned, you emailed me about HRV and heart rate stuff. When you inhale, you can see the heart rate go up. When you exhale, the heart rate goes back down. So it literally goes in line with your breath, every single breath. So you mentioned that slow exhale. That's usually where I start with athletes. So if you want to not have to think about all these things or count anything, just focus on slowing down your exhale a little bit longer than your inhale, and it's going to be relaxing for you.
I think that this concept is particularly important at the beginning of the swim, especially in cold water. A lot of athletes in cold water, they start hyperventilating because their face hits that water. They sort of seize up. And they forget to exhale. And it's like a rite of passage new triathletes in their first race and their first open water swim, 100 yards in, they're just panicking. You know, that CO2 is building. They have to turn over on their back or breaststroke to get everything under control. And then all of a sudden they relax. And then they remember, oh, I need to exhale. And so this concept is really relevant at the beginning of the swim, which again is the most stressful part of a triathlon. Again, you're already amped up, your adrenaline is pumping, you're nervous, and then you have to jump in water and swim, which is a foreign environment. A lot of people are afraid of drowning, and it's having the ability to rely on the calming effects of breathing well and being focused on breathing. I think it's really, really powerful stuff.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it pulls you out of your head, right? If you know when you jump in, you're just going to focus on your breathing. That's all you're going to worry about for that first little bit. Like maybe that's your kind of just way to help yourself out, stay focused and stay true, is just, I'm just going to focus on my breathing when you jump in. That's going to help you absolutely get a little further. The way you mentioned that reminds me of another drill I do with some of my athletes is, I'm sure y'all can relate to this too, is how I kind of explain it is like, if you just put on your shoes and you just walk outside and start running, the first 5-10 minutes is just terrible, right? You just, like, if you did no warm up or prep, everything feels gunky. You feel like you can't breathe, but then, you know, what, 5-10 minutes in, all of a sudden everything starts to even out and you can go. And that's really that CO2 building up, because you've just been sitting there, your kind of pH level in your blood has been fine. All of a sudden you start running and you start creating all this extra CO2 by running, and you feel that it hits you like a brick wall, and you have to kind of adjust to that new level of CO2. And once you do, then you are feeling a little bit better. You can breathe easier and you can calm down at the run. So what I'll do for any of my athletes, even their strength athletes or CrossFit, anything like that, if they're doing a warm up, I'll have them add in breath holds during their warm up. Same as just 1 or 2 minutes every 20, 30 seconds, they breathe out, they hold their breath for 4 or 5 seconds while they're jogging or on a bike or something. And it's not the most pleasant experience, I will say that, but you acclimate to it real fast. And then it just gets that kind of like gunky warm up sensation out real quick, and you're ready to go.
That's interesting. I have to try that one. It makes sense. And it makes me think about, you know, when your nose is blocked, and if you, the things you can do to get it unblocked, if only for a few seconds, is hold your breath.
Yeah.
Builds up and the body apparently responds by dilating, I guess,
it the sinus it.
Or whatever is up there.
Absolutely.
It makes sense. Pretty interesting. Yeah,
that CO2, all, you know, part of that same process is it's helping you actually deliver the oxygen better. So if you can hold more CO2 comfortably in your system, you actually deliver oxygen better to your muscle cells. So that's all going on at the same time. You're kind of opening up your blood vessels with the CO2. You're starting to get the oxygen actually being released to your cells the way you need. And that is just like a process that's, you might as well, like you said, just jump into the water and get it over with versus just letting it happen over time.
That's interesting. And before we hopped on, I was trying to read some studies, and, you know, I never heard of this concept, but it is interesting that there are some studies going on about how CO2 actually helps. We always think of it. I always thought of it as, you know, you want to expel it. It's like, it's a byproduct of energy production, and having it in your system obviously is, you don't want that, because it's that panicky feeling that your body responds to. I'm sure there's like different levels, but it is an essential part of, I guess, metabolism and endurance performance is having a good amount of CO2 and tolerating a higher amount. And I mean, is it the case that better athletes, stronger athletes, have the ability to hold more CO2 in their bodies?
It really depends. Like I said earlier, I mean, there's some athletes that you would think would be great at doing this, and they're still not. And they just have that ability to push through wherever they currently are. So it really still varies on the athlete. And I think but you're right. Like it's such an essential piece, and it does give you that extra benefit at the end of the day for even just utilizing the oxygen more. And I think the flip side of that too is if you're intolerant, you're exhaling more, but also if you haven't trained your respiratory muscles, like actually train the ability to exhale powerfully, then you're also missing the ability to, when you actually do need to get rid of the carbon dioxide. Cause at some point it's going to get to a level, unless, you know, you're doing like a zone 2 training session or something where maybe you want to be nose in, nose out. You want to train some of the CO2 tolerance, but when you're actually competing, at some point you're going to want to go full throttle and let it go. And if you can actually have the muscular endurance in your respiratory muscles to exhale that CO2 powerfully at that point, you're going to be able to kick it even harder.
Yep. And then one other facet of breath training that is interesting is this concept of, you know, if we tie it back to well-being and its role in kind of getting the parasympathetic nervous system going, which essentially relaxes you. To what extent can breath training enhance recovery? Because I know a lot of our, especially our top athletes who are training, you know, 25 plus hours a week, they recovery becomes the limiting factor. And what are your thoughts there? Just day to day and best practices and things like that.
Yeah. Obviously one thing we'll talk about is sleep, but even before that, I would say the biggest kind of low hanging fruit I see for most athletes for the recovery side of things is actually focusing on it immediately after a session. Yeah, I know a lot of times work with athletes where they get the session done, then they want to just walk out the gym or walk off the track or wherever it is and go right into their day or into what they have next. But one of the biggest things you can do is pull yourself back into parasympathetic state quickly afterwards, or else you're going to stay at this high sympathetic stress state from your training session, go right into your job or right to your kids or whatever it is, and you're just going to stay there, and your body's never had the chance to come back down and start that recovery process as soon as it could. And you're kind of just pushing off the chance for your body to start recovering. So one of the biggest things I do with athletes is immediately post training is, you know, once they kind of actually catch their breath, lay down. I like just the simple in for 4, out for 6 breath. So in for 4 seconds, out for 6 seconds. That slightly longer exhale we talked about earlier. And just really trying to pull yourself back down. And even if you have to, you know, take an extra minute or two before that, and you're taking big inhales, big exhales to recover, if it was a really hard session, still taking that time to lay down afterwards, do a few minutes of really, really controlled, slow exhale breathing. It's going to shift your state a lot quicker, help you begin recovering a lot faster. And you'll notice over time how much easier that gets too. So at first that might take you a few extra minutes to pull your heart rate down to maybe 100 beats a minute or less than that. But over time, the more you do that, it's amazing how quickly athletes can finish a training session where they're at peak heart rate. And in a couple minutes, boom, they're transitioned back down. And that's really a test of how well you can recover and giving yourself more time to recover.
So on the topic of recovery, I guess we'll jump in real quick and say, so we know like high, you know, HRV, we know the person is in a good state, and especially when they're sleeping. But is there breathing patterns that change too at night when people are sleeping, if they are well recovered versus not recovered?
The breathing patterns usually that are measured on someone's devices are more just the breaths per minute. And so, yeah, like if we have lower breaths per minute, that's going to be better. The breathing rate, which people aren't actually going to breathe like this naturally and they're sleeping, but the breathing rate that has the most correlation with a higher HRV is 6 breaths per minute.
Okay.
Which is pretty relaxed. So that in for 4, out for 6 ties into that. So it's a 10 second breath total when you do 4 and 6, and that ends up being 6 breaths per minute. And that's really correlated with that high arch of HRV. It's called coherence breathing. So it's essentially helping your breath and your heart rate come in line with each other. But yeah, ideally, whoops, sorry. Ideally during a sleep, that heart, that breath rate is going to drop down. It's going to be different per each person, but you just want to track over time that it's coming down if you're focused on that recovery.
Yeah, it so if when you're working with an athlete, what would that typically look like? Like if an athlete is interested in improving their breathing, what would maybe a typical protocol look like? Or I guess how do you approach coaching an athlete?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest thing I do first is, you always want to start with some sort of evaluation so you have somewhere to go. And so start with an evaluation, look at the CO2 tolerance, look at the breathing mechanics we mentioned. I also look at a lot of mobility. So one of the biggest things that can restrict an athlete is just literally not being able to get in positions where they can breathe efficiently. So if we think about swimming, for instance, if we need to put our arm overhead, and if we every time we put our arm over our head, it makes us extend our whole spine way out. So if I mean, if you puff your chest out, you extend your spine and try to take a deep breath, it feels almost impossible. And essentially, but the reason is because we need that diaphragm in this nice, like upside down U shape, so it can pull down and breathe well. But if our diaphragm is stretched out as it is when we extend our spine, all of a sudden the range of motion for it to flex is very limited. And so, if our back to the mobility piece, one thing I'm looking at is if we can't put our hands over our head without our whole spine extending, then that's really that like trickle down effect that's really limiting our breathing and affecting our efficiency. So, there's definitely things I'm looking at in the spine, the shoulders, the hips to just make sure. Let's at least put your diaphragm in a position where it even can function well, and then we can start training it. So basically, those are the things I'll look at. And then from there, based on what we see at the evaluation, we're going to start focusing on different, maybe a morning routine for their breathing to start increasing some CO2 tolerance, probably some sort of protocol with the BreatherFit device to strengthen their respiratory muscles. We're coming at the breathing from both of those sides and likely some sort of mobility drill based on what we need to expand there. And that's usually like a 12-week process of that one-on-one coaching to get them where they want to be. But obviously, just like any training program, we start off with the basics, and then we're going to really increase the resistance or increase the drills over time and expose them to a lot more.
Makes sense. And I guess, do you coach athletes in person and also remotely over Zoom?
Yeah, the majority of stuff I do is remote. Yeah, I mean, if you're in the Knoxville area, I'll work with you in person. But other than that, it's usually remote. And the majority of what I do really is putting in programs for them to follow. So, we check in a lot, but kind of similar to you all, like I'm going to give you the whole week and then you're going to follow that and we're going to communicate over how it's going throughout the week. And then what's interesting, if you go back to Katie, a lot of what I do with athletes who are, kind of at that level, they're getting training from people like you. And so sometimes I'll say, okay, what do you have this week for your training? And then that way I know, okay, these days she's cycling, these days she's strength training, and I can give her specific things to match her other training with her breathing.
Yeah, makes sense. Good stuff. And so where can athletes find you if they're interested in having you coach them or learn more about what you do and the other I guess the organizations you're affiliated with.
Yeah, absolutely. So the biggest things they can do, they can check me out on Instagram. I'm at Athlete Breath Coach. And you can find, lots of things on there as far as different drills I've done with athletes, but it's also where you can reach out to me if you're interested in coaching. And then if you want to pick up one of the tools I use, the BreatherFit, you can go to pnmedical.com and grab one of the devices there. So those are the probably two best places to find me and ask questions or get in touch.
Cool. One more time. Can you go over the protocol for the carbon dioxide tolerance again? Because I want to put a poll out in this podcast and see if people
The
want to
test.
post how many steps they can take. Yeah. So walk through the protocol one more time.
Okay, yeah, sure. Yeah, this is always the most eye-opening one as well. So I like doing this in groups too, because it gets people, it wakes everybody up real quick. Basically, you're just going to take a normal inhale, normal exhale. So it's a normal breath. People are always tempted to take a huge breath or to squeeze all their air out. Don't do that. Just normal in, normal out. Pinch your nose if you haven't done it before. Hold your breath and walk as far as possible. If you are doing this, even though you know you think you won't cheat, pinch your nose anyways, because you'll find a way to seep in some air without realizing it. So normal in, normal exhale, pinch your nose, hold your breath, walk as far as you can, and hold and count your steps. Okay. And just, yeah, like I said, go for it and see, push yourself an extra few steps so you don't think you can go further.
I can't wait to try the track workout on Thursday.
Yeah, it's always fun the first time you take somebody through it, because there's some physical reactions that they're not ready for, and it's a good time. I'm watching a group of people do it together.
I love it.
Awesome. Well, thanks for talking to us. This was fun, and I think it's
thank you for having me.
Really, really great stuff. And we'd love to get athletes breathing well, and we'll definitely encourage them to check you out. And maybe if we have a camp in between here, I'm based out of Nashville. So maybe if we have a training, we can get together and have a,
that'd be a blast. Yeah. We'll take them all through it together. We'll see how bad everyone's breathing, and if we can stress them out a little bit.
Definitely. Awesome. Well, thanks, Zach. And
yeah, thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
For sure. And if anybody wants to reach out to Derek or me, feel free to email info@workingtriathlete.com. And just once again, if you want to get in touch with Zach, check out his Instagram at athlete breath coach.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it. See ya.